Hey, this is Mike Gaston, founder, former CEO of Cut.com. I just sat with Ennis, had a great time. Definitely listen to this. I can't say that there's a lot of opportunity for wisdom in this, but there'll definitely be things that you can mock and make fun of. So check it out.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of I'm Made for More podcast. It's your host Ennis here, and today we have a very special guest. He's the man behind Cut.com, the multi-million dollar media company known to have cracked the secret of going viral with a YouTube channel of 10.2 million subscribers and over 4 billion views. It's the one and only Michael Gaston. From growing up in a traditional household, going against the grain and dropping out of college, to being in debt and having to file for bankruptcy at just 21 years old, to then bounce back and create a mid-8-figure business, Mike's story is a prime example of what it means to grab life by the horns. In this exclusive interview, Mike and I will discuss passion and how to find your path in life, how to beat your competitors in business, as well as how to grow your YouTube channel in 2021. Now, without further ado, enjoy this inspiring interview with none other than Michael Gaston.
Mike, thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course. So the first question I like to ask is, if there is one topic or concept that you can teach everyone in the world relating to either life or business, what concept would that be?
Man, only one? Okay. So I would encourage
everyone. I knew we were going to have this problem with you.
I would encourage everyone to, okay, how about this? We're living in a moment where it feels like conversations are more polarized than ever, right? Like there isn't a lot of middle ground or common ground, as it were. It feels like there are just two giant tribes barking at each other most of the time. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with kind of a general loss of ambiguity. And that comes with a media that has learned how to optimize audiences to the point where they kind of are trying to make them more efficient for advertising. And as a result of that, people get to a place where you're either in their tribe or not in their tribe. And that makes conversations nearly impossible. So the one thing I would like to try to teach people is that when it comes to life, the universe, and everything, there is a capital T truth. But because of our shape, our form as human beings, we will never know what that is. And yet, we are always trying to understand it. That's kind of like the tragic flaw of being a human being, right? Like this desire of knowing, this desire to know the truth. And then also just the fact that we will never achieve it. And so what that means is that's called absurdity. We're living in kind of like this this absurdity. And what that means for me is like, I know that I will never achieve capital T truth, but I'm always aspiring to it. I'm always trying to find an answer for it. And what I would encourage of people is to not be so beholden to things that they think that they know. Because I mean, how often do we go throughout life going, man, I thought I knew what I was doing. And then 2 years later, it turns out I was completely wrong the entire time, right? Like there needs to be room for ambiguity. And so I would encourage people to kind of like find that middle space, that gray zone where it's unclear, and spend some time there.
So what you're saying is life is not black or white. It's gray. Be open-minded and be empathetic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it. All right. So I want to get right into your story. You were born and raised here in Seattle, right? And in a pretty traditional household, your parents, you know, wanted you to go to school, go to college, get a job that paid well, get a house, get married, and so on, right? And actually, what I found interesting is they were super young when they had you. They were only like 22 at the time.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up in that, you know, traditional environment? And what was your relationship like with your parents?
Oh, that's interesting. Oh boy. I hope they're not listening to this. So I was actually born in, I was born in Virginia when my dad was in the military. And then we moved up here when I was about two, to Seattle. And it was definitely very traditional, as in I look like every other 80s kid, except my mom was an immigrant from the Philippines and didn't become a citizen until I was two. So that was a little bit different than like a lot of the other kids that I grew up with. They were traditional in the sense that, you know, my dad comes from a blue collar background. But my mom from the Philippines had this expectation of college. Together, they were basically the quintessential 80s, 90s parents, you know, mm-hmm. The expectation that you were going to work your way through school, go to college, get a good job, et cetera. That being said, you know, my grandfather, my mother's dad, was also a professional magician. And so it's kind of like, and like, you know, a bit of a professional gambler. And so there was always like that weirdness in the family. But my mom was the most straight of her siblings. And by that, I mean, like, she studied accounting for a period of time. And like, she was the eldest and always felt the most responsible. And so them having me at the age of 22 was pretty typical in that period that I grew up. But it wasn't what I would say a great experience. I remember my mom telling me when I was like 10, she's like, "Aren't you glad that you have such young parents? We're the hip, cool parents because we're so young." I was like, "No, you're bad at this." I was like, "You're too young. You don't know what you're doing." And that was kind of my experience. There was a lot of friction. I was like, from a very early age, I knew to ask myself what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I would just constantly try to position myself in such a way as that I would get the things that I wanted. And, you know, my mom grew up in a household where, you know, she did what her dad told her to do, because that's, or what her mom told her to do. Like, it was a very, you listen to your parents' culture in the Philippines. And then my dad, you know, he was in the military. And before that, his dad had been in the military. And so he, you know, you don't really listen to kids in that family. So it's kind of, I think I kind of was confusing to them.
Interesting. And growing up, were you a good student? Were you serious about school at all?
I was for right up until seventh grade. So like, my mom was a bit of a tiger mom, because, you know, it's just a total cliche, but I remember I could write essays before I got into kindergarten. Like, I was doing math and I was reading at well above kindergarten level, because my mom wanted, it was like prepping me for school. Mm-hmm. So everything was instantly boring when I got to school. And then every day there was homework, but then she would create more homework for me. And you know, I'd be studying constantly. And around seventh grade is when I started, a friend of mine introduced me to some books that opened up my eyes to kind of reflect on philosophical concepts. And that made me even more contrarian to the kinds of things that my parents wanted me to do. And then I started sort of testing my own experience. And as a result of that, I purposely started to do things just to test out the boundaries of what I could do. Like, I remember purposely, like, essentially tanking a religion class, getting all A's and everything else, but then just not doing any of the work for the religion class that I was in, just because I wanted to be like, well, what would be the big deal? What would happen as a result of this? Because everything was so important. My mom was like, "You got to get these types of grades so you can get into this high school, so you can get into this college, so you can get this job." And then once I tanked that class, my mom was like, "Why are you doing this? You're messing up your chances." I'm like, if everything pivots off of this class, something is fundamentally wrong with life. You know, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. And so that's why I started doing it. Just started testing the boundaries of what I had been told my whole life, and started to like carve out my own little space.
Okay, so you would say the seventh grade was the defining moment for you to start questioning the status quo and start going against the grain?
Yeah, like, up until that point, I was sort of like, just sort of instinctually obnoxious. Like, I was just sort of like instinctually disagreeing about things and wanting to do stuff. But seventh grade is when I became intentionally contrarian, where I was like, well, let me think about that and sort of decide for myself whether that makes sense or not, you know? And then it became a weird thing where it really was a test in my brain. Like all these little things I was doing was like a little experiment. Like, what will happen if I do this? How will the world react to me if I choose to do these things? Or, and it was never like, you know, I had personal ground rules for myself. It was never like, you know, I was antagonizing people. It was more like, it was about my life. This is my life. So, you know, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine at that time. And he was like, Mike, what do you value most of all? I mean, this is middle school. He was like, what do you value most of all? And he said, he goes, I value honor, right? Because his family is like, he had this very deep sense of honor in his family. And I was like, that's weird, man, because like honor is so external, right? It, like your whole worldview about yourself is based on how other people perceive you. That doesn't seem like really healthy. And then I said, freedom. I like value freedom more than anything. And then I remember vividly him going, you know, Mike, I think someday you're either going to be really successful or you're going to die in a ditch somewhere by yourself. Mind you, we were like in middle school. These are like, that's kind of really bleak conversation to have when you're in middle school.
No, that's crazy. Do you feel like that's changed? Is that still the same, that you value freedom the most?
Yeah, I absolutely value freedom over everything. Yeah. Okay. Personal agency is like way more interesting to me than any other kind of value.
Interesting. Okay. I could see that for sure. Fast forward to college, you went to Seattle U, right? For a semester, and then you dropped out. What was your thought process behind that decision, and how did you break the news to your parents?
Well, I was there for for about almost a year. So it was a little bit longer this semester, but like I really, at the time, my grandfather was dying. He had diabetes and he was like falling apart. And after school, I would go to his house and I would help take care of him. And that meant like, I would take him to the bathroom. I would wipe his ass. I would shower him. He was like, he couldn't feel the left side of his body. And he was basically blind. And it was the most depressing experience I ever had, you know, and no one really supported him except for my grandmother. Nobody else wanted to help out. And it's because my grandfather was a huge asshole. He was like the worst. He was the worst person ever. And the only reason why I did is because I was like the only person he liked. So I never had the same experience that other people had with him. And so I was helping him and helping my grandmother. And I was like, I can't keep doing this. It was like the most stressful, depressing thing to watch this person kind of like fall apart. And one day I was kind of musing about how I was like, man, I just need to leave. I just need to leave the country.
And how old were you at this point?
19. And I had gone abroad before. I had left. I had gone on a study abroad for a few weeks to Ireland before. But I was like, I just need to leave. And he straight up just told me, he goes, yes, you do. You need to leave. I want you to leave. I don't want you to see me like this. Go, like, now's the time, go. And so I just did. I just was like, I have to get out of here. And the truth is, I never wanted to go to college. I had told my mom that I wasn't interested, but you know, you know, Asian moms are so good at guilt tripping. And my mom guilt tripped me with the, you know, we've been sending you to private school since you were in first grade. And so like our expectation is that you get a college degree. And so I was sort of like ended up at Seattle University. And then I was like, I gotta get out of here. So then I just did, I just left.
So at this point, you're 19 years old. You decided it was a good idea to max out all your credit cards and travel the world, right? And you ended up living with a poet in Ireland, and he was someone that you considered as a mentor. Is that right?
Yeah. So like what happened was, you know how I was saying, like, I would experiment for myself. I would create little experiments. Well, one of those things was, I remember telling my grandfather, I was like, I wonder if there's a way that I could rob a bank and not go to jail. And then I thought about it.
You actually thought about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I thought about it. And I was like, how could I do that? And I was like, credit cards. I could take out a bunch of credit cards and not pay it back. I could eventually just claim bankruptcy. Isn't that what rich people do? I mean, I swear to God, this is literally verbatim what happened in my head. And I even mused taking out a bunch of cash advances and going to Las Vegas. I was like, eventually what I'll do is I'll make my way to Las Vegas and I'll just take whatever I have left and I'll play roulette with it. Like these are all concepts that I'm having. And he's like, yeah, you should just do it. Just fuck it. Just go do those things. And so I left. And at first I traveled the way kind of like every romantic college age student who has some kind of privilege travels, as in like I backpacked. I basically was really, really poor. I drank really cheap wine in train stations with homeless people because I had nothing. And then I just sort of like would hop on trains and get off before like I would get kicked off type of stuff. That isn't really attractive after a certain point. That's when I was like, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to go do that thing that I thought I was going to do. So I took out a bunch of credit cards and I decided to live like what I imagined wealthy assholes live like. And I started not having any luggage with me. It was like I had a JanSport backpack, and anytime I needed clothes, I would just go to a store and buy clothes, and then I would just leave clothes behind. And I remember talking to people and they go, how do you afford this, like all this stuff? And I was like, do you know the show Doogie Howser? And they go, yeah. And I go, I'm not saying that I'm Doogie Howser, but, and then I would just leave. And so like I just started, it was like a weird bit of role play. The whole thing was like this interesting kind of like, well, if you could just, if life is this finite thing, and we know that that's true, like there is an end, that's all we know. And you can't know capital T truth, right? All you can do is try to aspire to. And you can basically do whatever you want. Like the problem is most people sort of live in these lanes that they've been told their entire time that they have to live in. And I was really into kind of like discovering what new lanes could possibly be. And I freely admit that the reason why I was able to do those things is because, you know, I'm also living in a culture that that overvalues that kind of behavior in men, right? Like men can get away with that kind of attitude. And then I was like, so let me see how far I can take this. And that's what I did. I took out some credit cards. I ended up traveling the world. And then I was really broke, and I started living with this poet in Ireland on the Southwest Barrett Peninsula. And, you know, he would occasionally go to Wesleyan University in the US and teach. But otherwise he was just riding on this farm in the middle of nowhere. And at that time I was so poor, I had to go fish for food every day on the coast. And then he and I would meet up at like 1 a.m, where he would tell me the poetry that he had written. I would tell him the poetry I had written. And then we'd play chess until like 4 a.m. And then he'd set a bunch of tasks for me for the following day. Then the next morning I would go off and I would read or write or fish. And then he would go do his thing. And then we'd meet up again at 1 a.m. And then this would just go on for months.
Wow. Well, if there was one lesson that you took away from that whole experience, what lesson would that be?
Well, see, he was incredibly critical as like a writer. So, I mean, he would eviscerate literally everybody when it came to their writing, and himself. He was so self-critical about his own work. And what, you know, like there'd be classes of kids that would arrive in Alahees, the town that he lived in, and they would be there on a study abroad trip. And they would be there ostensibly to learn about poetry. But the thing that you learn quickly in writing groups is that most people who aspire to be writers don't really want to write. They want the appearance of being a writer, right? They want the achievement without any of the work. And so what happens is a group of like supposed writers will sit around in a circle and just validate each other all day long. And John's not about that. John, his name was John O'Leary, and John would really break it down for them, like the things that they needed to work on, the things that they were missing. And so kind of what I got out of that was an incredibly critical eye toward literally everything I did, just like a complete lack of satisfaction. Like I don't celebrate wins. Like it's not interesting to me to celebrate a win. I've done something, whether it's good or bad, I have to move on. And I'm going to just learn lessons from it. And then I just move on to the next thing. I don't sit there and cheerlead myself. So I think that was the thing that I got out of that experience the most.
Wow, dude, that is so important to have. You know, failing and moving on is one thing. But when you're winning, right, a lot of people get stagnant, right? And that's something I'm learning too. It's like, how can I keep raising the standards, raising the bar, and just keep getting after it? And you're saying just... yeah, how can one do that for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, You got it. Okay. So there's this weird lesson that I made for myself when I was really young, because even though I was very curious about the world and I would push boundaries a lot, I was also just generally freaked out about stuff. I was freaked out about new experiences. And so one of the rules that I made for myself was, if I'm afraid of doing it, I should probably do it. And then as a result of that, I ended up having a lot of really unique experiences. And so that I would encourage people to put themselves in uncomfortable positions. You know, like the easiest way to become complacent is just to put yourself in to treat yourself as if you're a factory worker, right? And your life is just a series of prescribed motions that you're making literally every single day. I wake up, I go here, I sit at this chair, I have my cup of coffee, I do exactly these things. And the thing is, what you're often told by creators, or like by people who have achieved some sort of level of success, is that you have to do these things. You have to do these types of motions in order to get to a place where you can really optimize yourself. And I'm like, that feels like death to me. Mm-hmm. It feels like a little bit like death, because it closes off on the ceiling. It lowers the ceiling on what's possible, because suddenly it's about like, it's like an assumption. Right? You've made an assumption that in order to achieve something, you have to do 10 of these things literally every single day, all the time until the end of your life. You're right. If you do those things, you are going to end up in a place where you will have focused enough on whatever it is that you will have extracted enough value out of it, right? Like, okay, but is that what you even really want? Right? Like most of the time when I talk to these potential creators, their whole thing is like, they don't even know what they want. All they want is to be rich, right? Mm-hmm. What a terrible end goal. You can have lots of money and be completely unhappy, right? And I know a lot of people who are really wealthy and are unhappy, and also are just like real boring, uninteresting people who seem to be like stuck in a place. And they're just as stuck as the people who have no money. Only they're to some degree even sadder, and they're sadder because they actually have the room to move, but they've chosen not to. And I think that's the thing. You just got to make yourself uncomfortable.
So for someone who is lost or maybe doesn't know what they want to do, what sort of questions should they be asking themselves to find their true calling?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a methodology for teasing out the thing that you really want to do. I mean, it took me until I was in my late 20s before I found my voice. When I was very young, I knew my general path, right? Like in terms of, I knew I wanted to be an artist of some sort, but I didn't know how that was going to shake out. Like originally I was an illustrator. I drew everything. And then that turned into eventually I became a writer, and that's what I became focused on. I didn't discover video until I was in my mid 20s. You know, I never went to school for it. And so it's one of those things where like, I just kept trying to find the mediums that would help to tell the kind of stories or invest myself in the type of work that I wanted to do. And so I would just encourage people just to ask themselves all the time, like, what do you want? I used to do these like really simple things at home where I would lie down. My wife makes fun of me about this now as an adult because I still do this. She calls it my think napping. I'd lie down on a couch and close my eyes, and I would kind of envision a question in my head, like, what do I want in this moment? What are the things that I'm really curious about? And I would just like let my brain free associate and just sort of figure itself out. And I don't know what it was about that. Like it's not like anything ever crystallized into like a simple aha or like, yes, this is the thing I'm doing. But for whatever reason, it gave me, it was like charging a battery, and it would energize me to continue on whatever that general path I thought I wanted was. So yeah, I would just encourage people to ask that question, what do you want? And you know, the thing is, if you ask most people to do that, they'll sit down, you know, and be like, close your eyes, ask yourself what you want. And they'll close their eyes and they'll ask themselves, and they won't know. And then that will freak them out. They'll have like an existential crisis about the fact that they don't quite know what they want. And then they'll immediately not want to be in the position of asking themselves that question, uh-huh. Right? They'll be like, oh, this question's hard. I don't even want to think about it. But that's kind of the point. You have to like really spend time in that uncomfortable place before you can even get close to knowing what it exactly it is that you want.
Totally. All right. So kind of taking a step back, going back. So you were in Ireland and then you decided to come back to the States, right?
Okay. Decided is a really generous term for so broke, I was like, I should probably go back home with the change in my pocket. But sure, yeah, I decided.
And you ultimately enrolled back into college. You went to the UW. Actually, how much in debt were you at the time?
I wish I had been in more debt.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, I mean, at the time, I was 21 when I claimed bankruptcy. And it was over just like $40,000+ or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I really wish it had been like, you know, several hundred thousand. But it's kind of hard to continue to take on debt when you're 20 years old. Like at a certain point, people are like, why are we still giving him credit cards? Like it doesn't make any sense. So it was like over a very small amount. But the truth is, I mean, I was crazy broke. At the time, like the most I ever made in a job was, you know, under $30,000+ in a year. So being $40,000+ in debt, I was working two jobs to pay for school and go to school. And I was going to school. So like, I felt like, oh God, there's no way out of this. I'm kind of like, I had created this really shitty scenario for myself. And at that point I was like, I think I have to claim bankruptcy now. So that way I can get out of this moment. It's time to pull the chute, which I had been kind of generally planning up to that point. And so I pulled the chute maybe earlier than I wish I had done. And like, if I had been smarter about it, I would have like even extracted even more money on that scenario. I ended up going back to school. At this point now, I actually wanted to go to school. And I knew what I wanted to study, which was English and the humanities and philosophy and that kind of thing. And I was way more excited about the University of Washington because it's a beautiful campus. It's like this. Seattle University was very similar to the high school I went to. I had gone to an all boys Irish Christian brothers high school that was literally two blocks away from Seattle University. So it was like going from the junior version to the senior version. And I was like, this is just too much. I have to get the fuck out of here. And UW was like a vastly different experience. I mean, I had incredible teachers like that had ended up having a profound impact on my editorial vision. Mm-hmm. Like I can still track things that I do now back to very specific teachers I had, from like Jocelyn K. Moody to Stephen Shapiro. And these people kind of like really informed my worldview at that time. So I'm really grateful for that experience.
So you graduate college and you land a dream job, right, at Boeing. And it seems like you were finally fulfilling your mom's dream, right? But then a few years later, you decided to quit. Or actually, you self-terminated. What was your experience like over there at Boeing, and why did you ultimately decide to leave?
Okay. After college, I got into graduate school to study Shakespeare in Scotland. And my girlfriend at the time got into Cambridge to study history. And she was like, you know, one of us should probably have a job. And I was like, well, you got into the much better school, so you go ahead and then I'll go find a job. And I applied to Boeing as a joke. And I think it's like one of those things where when you just don't want something, if you don't try to want something, it's the cliche is you end up getting it. And I remember getting the job at Boeing and going, well, let's, and it was really just sort of like when I was a kid and I would sort of tease out the boundaries of what I could get away with. I did the same thing at Boeing. I was like, well, do they even know who they hired? Let me see what it'll be like. I'll just join this thing. And so I did. And even though it was not an experience I would ever want to relive, I learned a bunch of things there. You know, I think the biggest lesson that I learned as I've kind of like gone through life is that everything is just an experience that can add to your tool set. Like, and the things that are the most difficult, the things that are the most irritating are the things that you actually learn the most from. And so that, again, going back into putting yourself in uncomfortable positions or scenarios that you didn't originally plan for yourself. And I think Boeing was one of those examples. I was just like, well, you know, can I actually thrive in an environment like this? And no one thought I could, because up to that point I had been sort of cast as this sort of like quixotic, temperamental, romantic, creative, right? Like if I'm working at a place where the products last for 40 something years and everyone wears blue button down shirts, am I going to survive? And so it was like a curious sort of experiment, and I joined it. But yeah, that I would say I learned a lot from that experience. But it was about several years into it that a friend of mine was in a in a band that had some success. They were an independent band and they were featured all the time on MTV and that kind of thing. And I told him, I was like, I want to make a music video for you. And he goes, well, Mike, you know, we have like Death Cab for Cutie directors hitting us up and blah, blah, blah. And you've never made any videos. You work at Boeing. And I was like, well, I'm just going to make you something. And if you like it, you guys can buy it. And if you don't, whatever, like it'll be a thing that I did. And when they were on tour, I made a music video for them and their label liked it and MTV liked it. So then the label bought it. And that's when I was like, okay, I got to get the fuck out of Boeing. And then it took about a year for me to finally leave Boeing. But when I did, it was the way I left was by self-terminating. And by that, I mean like Boeing has an internal kind of like, they have an intranet, right? Where you have your profile and you can do a bunch of things. One of the things they have in the top left corner, at least when I was there, was a big red button that just said, that was like to self-terminate. And I pressed the big red button one day and almost within like a minute, I got a phone call. And so I answered my phone and it was HR and they're like, hi, this is Boeing HR. And you know, we're just calling, is this Michael Gaston? I go, yeah, this is he. And they go, well, we're calling because, you know, we received a notification that you had pressed the self-terminate button on the website. And I go, yep. And they go, did you mean to do that? And I go, yeah. And they go, are you sure? I was like, yeah, yes. They go, you do know that it's going to be very difficult to reverse this once we put this through. And I'm like, do people want to reverse things? And they go, why would I want to reverse it if I've pressed it? Yeah. And they go, so do you want to reverse it? I go, not this time. And they go, what does that mean? And then it gave, there's this long kind of like who's on first conversation with them until eventually I was just like, I'm not coming back. Please stop asking me. Because, you know, they you know, companies invest a lot into people. And I had done a bunch of things and you know, it's difficult to like let go of people that even though they are unhappy, like are providing value for the company. And so HR's job was to kind of talk you out of it. And after like 20 minutes of it, they finally accepted the fact that I wasn't going to stay. And the last thing I had to do was just sort of like drop off my credit card and computer and a few other things. But just the whole scenario of like pressing this internal button, I felt like I was in like a Thomas Pynchon novel or something. I was like, what is this? What is this that you can... You can just go online and there's a red button to press, like I'm ejecting or something. It was hilarious.
That is hilarious. All right. So then you leave Boeing. At what point did the idea of Cut come about?
Cut kind of was serendipitous. So that was a long time. After Boeing, I worked for free for a really long time to learn how to make videos after I made that music video. I figured I didn't know really what I was doing, even though I had success. So my goal was like just to do a bunch of free shit to figure out like, was it really like to make things? Did that for about a year. Then I fell into the CBS Radio Seattle trap. Once I left that, I created a digital humanities nonprofit with my cousin, who is like an anthropology student at the University of Washington. I did that for a little over a year before I discovered Stripes 39, where I worked and did videos for them and really kind of like learned how to create content that spreads. And it was about a year after that, that after talking with Salil and sort of going back and forth on different models, that I told him, I was like, really what we should be doing is just making the sort of content that are going to have an impact on people's lives. And it's going to be of such intrinsic value to them that they are willing to pay for it or things related to it. And at that, he became convinced. And I go, okay, well, if I do this and I make some stuff really quickly that kills it, you know, like you're going to give me cut.com. That'll be one of the things that was one of the properties his company owned.
Yeah.
And he goes, sure. And then within a couple of weeks, I made a video called Grandma Smoking Weed for the first time. And then like a week after that, 100 Years of Beauty launched. And then another series called Truth or Drink, I believe, or Sexy Charades or something. Every single thing we were making was going kind of crazy viral. And that's how Cut came to be. And then within about of like, I want to say a month or so of launching all these properties, the editorial vision and the model sort of crystallized and became a thing. Like I had taken all these disparate threads in my imagination. I pulled it in, pulled it together to kind of create a vision for this thing that I wanted to make.
So like you said, Cut is known as the company to have cracked the secret of going viral, right? And you've been able to grow the Cut YouTube channel to over 10 million subscribers and garner over 4 billion views. What advice do you have for someone who's just starting a YouTube channel or someone who's, you know, has one but hasn't got the traction that they wanted?
I mean, usually when people ask that question, they want some like hardcore mechanics, right? They want to know like literally, it's sort of like you go to somebody who is like in incredible shape and you're like, tell me what your workout routine is. What do you eat? I'm just going to do the same exact thing or whatever, right? And so I could tell people, well, the algorithm favors watch time. So make really long videos, make a lot of them because so much of how people discover you is through the recommended page. I could say all that. And I could say, hone in on one category of content and produce that over and over again. All those things are true. And if you do that, you will likely develop a channel over time that will have a substantial amount of users on it. As you can tell, if you look at Cut, we did none of those things. So it was like, we would make really a huge variety of content. And we purposely avoided creating personalities. Like we did all these things that are like the worst practices you can possibly do on YouTube. And that, again, that was me kind of going, well, I don't want to do the best practices because I don't actually want to compete with other channels. Like that's not interesting to me. Like the audience doesn't care if I beat X, like whatever category. They only care if you create value for them, right? So is it possible for me to develop an audience without leveraging any of these things? And, you know, in my head, the thing that just occurred to me was in a world of 4 billion, you know, people watching videos online, I only need like a million being into my stuff in order to have something substantial. And what's going to get a million people to really get into my stuff is if I have a very clear editorial vision. And so what I would say to people is like, just generally speaking, there's sort of like like four things that I think about. And note, this is not a formula. These are just principles for how I think about making any kind of work. First one is going, like, what do you want, right? And by that, I mean, what do you want for this thing that you've started? And when I go talk to people out in the world, they'll tell me things like, oh man, I want to be able to live my life as a storyteller. I want to be able to travel the world and do it. I want to van life or whatever. I want to make $1 million. And I'm like, okay, be more ambitious. And they're like, I want to make $10 million. I want to buy my own jet or whatever. I want 100 million subscribers. And I go, great. Well, what about a need state that isn't just about you? And that's when that kind of blows their mind. And by that, I mean going, if you focus your want on literally just what you want, you don't give anyone an opportunity to get to bandwagon because strangers don't give a shit about whether or not you're rich. They don't care if you're fulfilling your life's, you know, purpose. They care about the things that they care about. And so it's better to think about a need state, a want that actually meets not just your needs, but the needs of a whole lot of other people, right? So if like a need state could be curing cancer, or in my case, the want that I wanted to create was I wanted there to be less assholes in the world. And so that's like an overly ambitious need state because I felt like we have an overabundance of assholes and we need less of them. But it meets it for a whole lot of people. And it's the kind of ambitious want that it's questionable whether or not you can ever achieve it, right? And the reason why it needs to be that kind of crazy and ludicrous is because you will almost certainly never achieve the thing that you ultimately want. So you might as well make the destination so nuts that you'll, like, even if you get close to it, you'll have had a profound impact. Whereas like if you make it just sort of achievable, okay, great, you hit the goal, but how close were you to like this core of like this much bigger idea? So I begin there. And then the next question I ask people is like, what is your intervention? What is the thing that you can do that literally nobody else can do? Right? Define that. What is that thing? And for me, it was, well, I can create work. I can create videos that care more about people, the subjects of the video, and respect the audience in a way that other digital media companies don't. And I can do it with an editorial vision and value set that these other companies aren't going to live by because they're too focused on extracting value out of the audience. I can do that because these guys can't. And because these guys are thinking about the audience in terms of like strip mining some sort of resource, right? And then the next thing you got to do is like define your value set. What are the things about you that are going to be the guiding principles that are going to determine the type of content that you're creating? And then out of that, you have to define what you think are the behavioral changes that you're going to create out of all this that are going to lead back to getting to that need state, right? And so for me, it was less assholes in the world, create the kind of content that's empathetic and respects the audience in a way that nobody else does. My value sets are theory of mind, diversity, continuity of identity, sincerity. And then the behavioral change I wanted was for people to appreciate ambiguity. I figured if people can appreciate that, then there will be less assholes in the world. So like, I feel like if you do that, what happens is you create this sort of like really singular vision. And when people find you, they're like, oh, they're attracted to it. They're attracted to it because like so many things are so wishy-washy, you know, or yeah. Like they're, or they're the same because everyone's trying to kind of compete with each other. Yeah. And so that's why I would encourage new storytellers to kind of like think about.
Definitely. I think Alibaba founder Jack Ma said it. He's like, if you want to die in business or you want your company to die, basically copy what your competitors are doing.
Yeah, man. I mean, that is one point of contention between Salil and I early days. The person who mentored me at Stripes, as I remember when I was making the company and he was like, Mike, you need to go and copy everything that BuzzFeed and Upward that you're doing. And I was like, well, why? And he goes, well, they have all the money. If they have all the money, they can afford the, you know, the technologists and the data scientists that are essentially creating the tools for predicting virality. And I go, well, I don't know in the history of anything where a smaller force somehow defeated a larger force by copying the strategies and tactics of the larger force. Like that doesn't make sense. Like you have to actually, you have to be kind of like, it's an asymmetrical warfare, right? Like I can't go at them in the same way that they are doing it because I'm going to lose that ground every single time. So that's number one. And then number two, why do I even care about fighting them? You know, the audience doesn't care if I beat BuzzFeed or BuzzFeed beats me. So like, why should I care? The only thing I should care about is like, how can I create value for the audience in a way that gets the thing that I want? So yeah.
Interesting. So something I heard you say in an interview that is that one of the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs make is stay in the weeds of things. Can you expand on that? And at what point should someone delegate their work? So if someone's maybe really great at video editing, but wants to build something huge, they shouldn't just, you know, focus in on video editing. They should delegate that work. At what point should someone do that?
Do you mind if I even like put a caveat there in that statement? I think the thing is like, it's not that it's a mistake to be in the weeds. It's that if you want to scale something, if you want to grow a company, you can't stay in the weeds. Part of the reason why I left Cut is because I actually like the weeds. And it got to a point where it became difficult for me to continue to operate as a CEO of a company when I wasn't satisfied with the work. I felt alienated from the creative. And as someone who makes creative, I needed to be in it again. But I also recognize like there's that tension. A good CEO doesn't stay in the weeds. The good CEO hires really brilliant people and then empowers them to be successful and to go out and do their thing. Because there's a CEO has a job to do that's separate. You know, it's about like leading the vision of the company, embodying the values and kind of like creating business partnerships and all that other kind of stuff. And so what I would say is like what happens, I think for some people, like whether you're a really great coder or artist or whatever, is you do this work and then people are like, they're like, wow, this is really valuable or this is really cool or there's something really unique about them. And then something happens where they're like, let's just pour water on this thing and make it even bigger. And then suddenly you're in a position where you might've been an artist or a coder, but now you're running a company. And there's really just two routes you can go, right? Or I guess there's three. One is you continue to behave like a coder and the thing doesn't go anywhere. It can't because you can't, it's like now you have all this money, but you're not really trusting the people that you've hired. And it doesn't go anywhere. The other one is sort of like a half in, half out. That ultimately also doesn't go anywhere, but you might survive for a while. right? And it's like a boutique kind of like small business. Essentially, you're dabbling in everything. And I was like that for the first couple of years I cut, where I was the equivalent of a benevolent dictator. You know, it's sort of like I was really prescriptive with what I wanted to see done all the time. And what happens is you become the bottleneck to everything, because people start to realize that they can't get shit done unless you say yes to it or say no to it. So suddenly you're getting hit up for everything, and then you feel really valuable. Well, I'm clearly important because people keep coming to me. They need my answers for everything. But in reality, all you've done is decide that the company will never grow beyond you, right? And then the last way is the way where you're like, okay, I'm in this new job. My job is to run a company. That requires a completely different set of skills. In order to become successful, I actually have to do those and not do other things, right? If you are doing if you're doing the coding job as a CEO, then you are doing somebody else's job and no one is doing your job, right? That's bad. That's really, really bad. So I think if you actually want to create a company that scales, that you actually have to become a different type of, you have to take on a different role. You know, and like Zuckerberg, for example, is a perfect example of that. Like, this is a guy who like coded a bunch of shit in his dorm room. At some point, he had to decide to be a CEO. And like really focus on developing those skill sets to be an effective CEO. It just so happens that I stopped being interested in that shit. I wanted to go back to making things.
Well, there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, please take a minute and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. I'd love to see your feedback there. And until the next time, dream big, because you, my friend, are made for more.